From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Denver, Colorado.
This is not a day for excuses. I made a mistake, we've made a mistake, and I'm sorry for it.
As Dan Rather apologizes for documents used in a story about Bush's National Guard service that Republicans charge is a Democratic conspiracy, but most agree the scandal only helps George Bush. We'll speak with veteran Texas journalist Jim Moore. And what if the model being used to dissect Dan Rather was applied to all the corporate media for its coverage in the build-up to the invasion of Iraq? We'll speak with Harper's publisher, Rick MacArthur. Then we take a look at Boulder community radio station, KGNU. It just countered a wave of media consolidation by purchasing a commercial radio station in Denver.
As the corporate media act as a megaphone for those in power, and those in power wage war, people are demanding alternative, independent media, and we must provide that. I believe our democracy is at stake.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Today we're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. I'm Amy Goodman. On the campaign trail, Senator John Kerry accused President Bush of creating, quote, a crisis of historic proportions in Iraq because of, quote, colossal failures of judgment. In a major address at New York University, Kerry gave his harshest critique yet of Bush's policies in Iraq and outlined his plan to improve the crisis. Kerry said, quote, in Iraq, this administration is consistently overpromised and underperformed. This policy has been plagued by a lack of planning and absence of candor, arrogance, and outright incompetence, he said. John Kerry outlined a four-point plan to improve the situation in Iraq. He said he would get more help from other countries, provide better training for Iraqi forces, increase benefits to the Iraqi people, and ensure elections take place next year as scheduled. Bush responded to Kerry's speech by accusing his opponent of shifting his position on Iraq once again. Today, Bush is scheduled to outline his plans in Iraq in his address before the General Assembly of the United Nations. In news from Iraq, the American contractor Eugene Armstrong has been executed by the captives who kidnapped him alongside two other contractors last week. A video of Armstrong being beheaded was aired on Arabic television yesterday. Armstrong was shown blindfolded, wearing an orange jumpsuit and sobbing. U.S. officials have reported recovering his body. Armstrong's killers are now threatening to execute one of the other two contractors unless all Muslim women are released from Iraqi prisons. In other Iraq news, two prominent Sunni clerics have been assassinated. Both were members of the influential Association of Muslim Scholars. Meanwhile, a commander of the armed wing of the Shiite Supreme Court Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq was killed along with his wife north of Karbala. In Mosul, a car bomb killed three. In Fallujah, the U.S. continued airstrikes, killing at least two people. The Los Angeles Times has revealed that U.S. military investigators have opened a criminal probe into allegations that U.S. troops tortured and murdered an 18-year-old Afghan soldier, Jamal Nasir, last year while he was in U.S. custody. The investigation is also examining the alleged torture of seven other Afghan soldiers, none of whom were linked to al-Qaeda or the Taliban. The U.S. allegedly beat the detainees, immersed them in water, gave them shocks, hung them upside down, and tore off their fingernails, their toenails. This, according to Afghan investigators and an internal memo prepared by a UN delegation that interviewed the surviving soldiers. Some of the Afghan soldiers were reportedly beaten to the point they could no longer walk or sit. One witness described Nasir's battered corpse as, quote, green and black with bruises. According to the LA Times, the U.S. Army had stymied previous attempts to investigate the murder and torture, but the Army reopened the probe in response to questions from the newspaper. In other news, two U.S. soldiers were killed in southern Afghanistan near the Pakistani border. In the northern province of Kunduz, one of the country's vice presidents survived an assassination attempt after a roadside bomb went off near his 20-vehicle convoy. Meanwhile, U.S. military officials are reporting members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban recently held high-level meetings in Pakistan to discuss ways to derail the October 9th Afghan election. Newsweek is reporting the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency have conducted war games to study what would happen if the U.S. preemptively attacked Iran's nuclear facilities. The agencies reportedly concluded such an attack would not resolve the standoff with Tehran. The U.S. has accused Iran of secretly building nuclear weapons, but Iran claims its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Today, President Mohammad Khatami said that Iran will continue its nuclear program even if that means an end to U.N. oversight. It also announced today it started converting raw uranium into the gas needed for enrichment, a process that can be used to make nuclear weapons. Khatami said, quote, "We've made our choice, yes to peaceful nuclear technology, no to atomic weapons," he said. Yesterday, the chief nuclear watchdog at the United Nations, Mohammed Al-Baradei, said Iran's program did not present an imminent threat. El-Baradei also said yesterday there now are at least 40 countries that know how to produce nuclear weapons. He urged the international community to tighten world policing of nuclear activities and for the UN to stop relying on voluntary compliance by member nations. In Haiti, more than 600 people have now died following devastating floods caused by Tropical Storm Jean. The northern coastal city of Gonaive has been hit the worst. The United Nations is estimating 80% of the city's 200,000 population has been affected by the floods. CBS News yesterday acknowledged it is no longer vouching for the authenticity of the memos about President Bush's National Guard service. Dan Rather said, quote, "We've been misled on the key question of how our source for the documents came into possession of these papers." We'll have more on this story in just a few minutes. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Intelligence Committee is expected to approve the nomination of Republican Congressmember Porter Goss as the new Director of Central Intelligence. The full Senate will soon start debate on the nomination. Some Democrats have expressed concern that the former CIA officer is too partisan and too close to the White House to carry out the job. Yesterday, Goss admitted for the first time some pre-war statements by senior Bush administration officials might have overstated available intelligence about the threat posed by Iraq. In other intelligence news, a group of September 11th families went to Washington yesterday to urge lawmakers to oppose all amendments designed to extend or expand the Patriot Act and not to link the passage of the 9/11 Commission with the expansion of the Patriot Act. And in election news, a federal judge yesterday struck down more than a dozen of the government's current rules on political fundraising with just weeks before Election Day. The judge concluded federal regulators had improperly weakened the nation's campaign finance laws.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me...
Thompson singing, Is It for Freedom? Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, broadcasting on more than 275 Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV, PBS, and both satellite networks, on Dish Network's Free Speech TV, channel 9415, and Link TV, channel 375 of DirecTV. I'm Amy Goodman. With 6 weeks remaining until Election Day, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry yesterday issued what's being called his most definitive statement yet on the war in Iraq. Kerry's stance on the war has come under criticism for being too vague or too similar to President Bush's. But in a speech yesterday at New York University, the Democratic candidate issued what's being called his clearest enunciation to date on Iraq.
Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator who deserves his own special place in hell. But that was not in and of itself a reason to go to war. The satisfaction that we take in his downfall does not hide this fact. We have traded a dictator for a chaos that has left America less secure. Now, the president has said that he miscalculated in Iraq and that it was a catastrophic success. In fact, the president has made a series of catastrophic decisions from the beginning in Iraq. At every fork in the road, he has taken the wrong turn and he has led us in the wrong direction.
John Kerry speaking in New York yesterday. His speech timed one day ahead of President Bush's scheduled address to the UN General Assembly today, in which he's expected to defend his policy in Iraq. On Thursday, the president will meet with the unelected Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi at the White House. 2 hours after Kerry's speech, President Bush hit back at his opponent at a campaign stop in Derry, New Hampshire.
Today, my opponent continued his pattern of twisting in the wind with new contradictions of his old positions on Iraq. He apparently woke up this morning and has now decided, no, we should not have invaded Iraq. After just last month saying he still would have voted for force, even knowing everything we know today. Incredibly, he now believes our national security would be stronger with Saddam Hussein in power, not in prison. Today he said, and I quote, "We have traded a dictator for a chaos that has left America less secure." He's saying he prefers the stability of a dictatorship to the hope and security of democracy. I couldn't disagree more. And not so long ago, so did my opponent.
President Bush at a campaign stop in Derry, New Hampshire yesterday. With Iraq in the midst of one of the bloodiest periods since the beginning of the U.S. invasion, there's another story that in many media circles is dominating the news. That's the controversy over documents used by CBS anchor Dan Rather in a story on President Bush's National Guard service during the Vietnam War. After nearly 2 weeks of defending its reporting against accusations that the documents in the report were fraudulent, Dan Rather and CBS News apologized last night for what Rather called a mistake in judgment.
News about CBS News and the questions surrounding documents we aired on this broadcast and on the Wednesday edition of 60 Minutes on September 8th. The documents purported to show that George W. Bush received preferential treatment during his years in the Texas Air National Guard. At the time, CBS News and this reporter fully believed the documents were genuine. Tonight, after further investigation, we can no longer vouch for their authenticity.
That was Dan Rather last night and his own newscast. He also announced that CBS is convening an independent panel to investigate the controversy and that the network will make the findings public. An hour before the CBS Evening News went on the air, Dan Rather was interviewed on the local New York CBS affiliate, where he first issued his public apology.
I made a mistake. I didn't dig hard enough, long enough, didn't ask enough of the right questions. And I trusted a source who changed his story. It turns out he'd misled us, lied to us about one thing. But there are no excuses. This is not a day for excuses. I made a mistake. We made a mistake, and I'm sorry for it.
At the center of the controversy are documents CBS now says it received from retired Texas National Guard officer Bill Burkett. The network said yesterday Burkett gave veteran CBS producer Mary Mapes a false account of the origins of the documents, which were allegedly authored by the late Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Killian. CBS said Burkett originally told them he obtained the documents from another former guardsman, but now says he got them from a different source, whose identity CBS News has been unable to verify. Last night on the CBS Evening News, Rather aired an interview he did with Burkett over the weekend.
Why did you mislead us?
Well, I didn't totally mislead you. I did mislead you on the one individual. You know, your staff pressured me to a point to reveal that source.
Well, we were trying to get the chain of possession.
I understand.
And
that.
You said you had received them from someone.
I understand.
And we
that.
Did press you to say, well, you received them from someone, and that
yes.
someone was whom. And it's true, we pressured you because it was a very important
yes.
point for us.
And I simply threw out a name that was basically, to get a little pressure off for a moment.
Have you forged anything?
No, sir.
Have you faked anything?
No, sir.
But you did mislead us. You
yes,
used
I
the word
it.
Lie. You,
yes,
you,
I did.
You lied to us. Why would I or anyone believe that you wouldn't mislead us about something else?
I could understand that question. I can. That's going to have to be your judgment and anybody else's.
Burkett still insists the documents are real, but says he was in no position to verify them.
I also insisted when I sat down with your staff in the first face-to-face session, before I gave up any documents, I wanted to know what you were going to do with them. And I insisted that they be authenticated.
Since the CBS story aired on September 8th, controversy has swirled over the authenticity of the documents, the question of who created them, and ultimately who facilitated getting the documents into Dan Rather's story. The Republicans and their allies in the corporate media began a whirlwind of rumors and speculation that the documents were part of a Democratic Party smear campaign. As evidence, they point to the fact that shortly after the CBS story aired, the Democrats launched a major series of attack ads focusing on Bush's National Guard record, the so-called Fortunate Son campaign. To compound these accusations, reports emerged yesterday that a key aide to John Kerry called Bill Burkett at the behest of CBS producer Mary Mapes. Former Clinton press secretary Joe Lockhart says Mapes told him there were some records, quote, that might move the story forward. Lockhart said he talked to Burkett for a few minutes and that Burkett had, quote, some advice on how to deal with the Vietnam issue and the Swift Boat allegations, saying Burkett told him, quote, these guys play tough and we have to put the Vietnam experience into context and have Kerry talk about it more. Lockhart said he did not recall talking to Burkett about Bush's guard records and called the accusations that the Kerry campaign was involved baseless. Senior Kerry advisor, former Senator Max Cleland, also spoke to Burkett before the story aired. And USA Today reported yesterday that Burkett said he also spoke to Howard Dean before the story aired. Further, the key figure in the CBS segment, Ben Barnes, who says he intervened to get Bush into the Guard at the behest of George H.W. Bush, is listed on John Kerry's website as a vice chair of fundraising for Kerry in Texas. Add to this the fact that Burkett is a known Bush critic who's posted anti-Bush comments on a Democratic website in Texas. And the pundits have spun this as a Democratic hatchet job orchestrated by Kerry supporters, if not by the campaign itself. Here's what White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan told reporters yesterday. Note that his comments were made well before, rather went on the air last night.
Announcement by CBS and their additional conversations with Mr. Burkett raise a number of serious questions. These are serious questions that are being raised. They need to be answered in terms of what contacts people had, what contacts did Mr. Burkett have with Democrats. There are reports that he had senior-level contacts with members of the Kerry campaign. There are reports that he misled CBS on who the original source of the documents were. Those are serious questions. Why did CBS rely on Bill Burkett, a previously discredited source, for this information? CBS said that he was an unimpeachable source. The fact is, he is not an unimpeachable source. He is a discredited source from the past and someone who has been very involved with Democrats.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan speaking yesterday. But while the Republicans are spinning this as a Democratic conspiracy against Bush, few observers would disagree that this scandal only helps the Bush campaign. The very real issue of Bush's record in the Texas National Guard has now been trumped by the controversy over the documents and the fate of one of the most famous newsmen in America. Last night, in his interview with a local New York CBS affiliate, Rather was asked if he thought he had been, quote, set up.
But certainly anybody who's been in journalism, as I have, for as long as I have, you're going to accumulate enemies. Some of those are going to be enemies because they have their own partisan political agendas or ideological agendas. But we are responsible. We've made a mistake, and we have to own up to it, and we did own up to it today.
Did somebody try to set CBS up?
I don't think so. And even if they did, it was our job to find that out. No, I don't think we were set up for it. You never can rule anything completely, totally out. You know, beware of certitude is one of the laws of journalism, but I don't think we were set up, no.
Now,
the mistake was ours. Where the wound in this case is self-inflicted.
That was Dan Rather on the local CBS affiliate in New York last night. When we come back, we'll be joined by James Moore. He's co-author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush President. We'll also speak with Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine. Stay with us. John Coltrane, Spiritual, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, and James Moore, who wrote the book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush President. James Moore, you're in Texas right now. First of all, your response to this overall controversy.
Well, I think it's terribly, terribly sad that what has happened to CBS has happened. I don't think there's any doubt. Hello?
You tell us about your assessment of what took place, what you see at this point as having happened.
Well, it's technically hard to know until yesterday when I heard the story about the envelope being turned over to Bill Burkett in Houston. What I don't understand is why Burkett would continue to protect the source, an individual whom he does not know, as well as why CBS did not do an adequate job of vetting the document. When I was first provided a copy of the document, a number of references in it, as a result of my long familiarity with Mr. Bush's released file, a number of references in the document, such as OETR rather than OER for Officer Effectiveness Report, and the abbreviation for group, flight group, is in this document was GRP rather than the Air Force standard of GP. There's a reference to billet, which is an Army term. There are just a number of things that jumped right out, and I doubted the veracity of the documents. Now, Bill Burkett, on the other hand, is someone I've been checking out for almost 2 years, and even the people who today are calling him a liar, when I first began checking him out, had described him as a truth-telling, stand-up guy who, when he opened his mouth, he was always honest, and he worked himself very hard, had impeccable credentials and work and ethical standards, and yet now he's obviously misled CBS and is clearly guilty of lying in some regard.
In the guest commentary you wrote for BuzzFlash.com, Jim Moore, you said that the first lie actually belongs to President of the United States, that no one any longer has doubt that there are records missing from the president's military personnel records jacket. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if the president had simply or would simply still today come forward and offer an explanation of his grounding, it was something more than just not showing up for a physical. You have standing orders as a pilot to get a physical every single year. Our president, who is now crossing the country and promising to protect the country in times of terror, had made a similar pledge when he was a young man to protect the country for 6 years, and he didn't do that. And there's not an explanation that has ever been offered by him as to why he did not take that physical, nor has any reporter ever asked him point blank, Mr. President, why did you not take your physical? The only person to ever answer that question has been Dan Bartlett, and Bartlett always offers a rather insufficient explanation that the president was no longer flying, so it was just a formality. Well, the truth is, a pilot does not get to unilaterally decide 4 years into a six-year hitch that he is not going to fly anymore. The president disobeyed orders, and he's not explained that. And documents that are required by regulation, now I've studied these regulations rather extensively, and when a pilot is grounded, that pilot is then required, the commanders are required to conduct a board of inquiry. And that board of inquiry has to issue a report on its findings, as well as what is referred to as a counseling statement. And that counseling statement informs the pilot how he might rehabilitate himself and get back in the air or get reassigned. Mr. Bush, none of these records are in Mr. Bush's file. They're missing.
You wrote the book, James Moore, Bush's Brain. You speculate in your piece about these CBS memos. Can you do that for us now?
Well, I think there are a number of things that have to be considered, and I know that people have often said of me and any number of other people who've watched Karl Rove for years that we sort of give him credit for more than he deserves. But I, like any other political reporter who's been around for 20 or 30 years, knows talent when they see it, and I've watched Rove closely for over 20 years, almost 25 years, and he's the best there is. He's the best there ever has been at political skullduggery, and it is not beyond comprehension for him to have planted these documents, knowing that that they might surface and get them into the right hands. Mr. Burkett doesn't know the individual who gave them to him. He has checked out the background of this person and says he may have had access to the National Guard, but he doesn't know the person. He never met the person. The individual who gave him the documents, apparently, he had no way of knowing if that was the person who called him on the phone. He appears on television, and all of a sudden he gets a mysterious phone call, and a few months later, when he is at a livestock show, he gets these documents, and they're planted. They're either planted or someone who was so angry about what Mr. Bush was doing to the country recreated something that they knew was in the original file. Either way, we have a situation where the good guys ended up using lies to take on the bad guys, and now they've smeared themselves and they've covered up what I think is a critical question about our president's background, and that is how did he behave at a time in our country's history when he had taken a pledge to protect us during the war in Vietnam. And I think the context for this is what's critical, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of the president's National Guard service. He is presently calling young people into active duty from the National Guard, and they are dying in Baghdad and all over Iraq. And these are young people that are supporting our war and serving based upon their pledge. And Mr. Bush's war would be nowhere if those young people were acting as irresponsibly as he did. And I think that this goes to his moral authority to call people to active duty and to send them into combat.
But, James Moore, could you explain more why would... I mean, this is something that's been swirling around for the last few weeks. Did Karl Rove plant these documents? But why would it be in any way in George W. Bush's interest?
Say that again.
Can
why
you
wouldn't it be in George W. Bush's interest?
Why would it be? I mean, this whole controversy. Yeah, these whole allegations.
Oh, this is a standard Rove tactic to attack the messenger rather than the message. If you can discredit the messenger, therefore you've discredited what the messenger is saying. Now look at the fact that the White House has believed that Bill Burkett was discredited by the Boston Globe story back in February. Now, if we can get documents into the political discourse and attach them to Bill Burkett, and during this process, his personal medical files were leaked that showed he had a nervous breakdown while he was suffering from a viral attack he contracted in Panama. Well, if you can take a story that is generally viewed as probably true by the majority of people, and you can attach that story to someone who is discredited, well, you pretty much destroyed the story, and that would serve the president and this whole National Guard controversy quite well. And frankly, from now on, I think in any political campaign for some time to come, when documents surface, people are immediately going to say, oh, it's not one of those National Guard things, is it? Because Bill Burkett has been discredited, and this story has now been discredited. And if this were a political tactic or strategy employed by Rove or by Republican operatives, it's worked quite well.
Hmm. James Moore is author of Bush's War for Reelection and co-author of the book Bush's Brain. We're also joined by Rick MacArthur, who is publisher of Harper's Magazine. Welcome to Democracy Now, Rick. Your response to this controversy, to Dan Rather, to the memos.
Well, I'm appalled by Dan Rather because I think, or by, I don't know that Dan Rather has done any reporting in 30 years, but he is the supervisor of his producers. And as an investigative reporter, I just I can't believe how stupid they were. I mean, you have to ask yourself, have they ever read any history? Do they know anything about the Hitler diaries? Remember the Hitler diaries? The Stern in Germany bought these forged diaries, and before you knew it, even one of the most famous historians of Nazi Germany, Hugh Trevor Roper, had been conned. Harper's Magazine itself published a document about 10, 12 years ago about George Bush Sr.'s record as a Navy pilot, because he strafed some survivors of a Japanese lifeboat, and the press covered it up, didn't want to publish it. We did it after the election, after Clinton beat him. But when you check out a document, you take it to the source. You take it all the way to the source. The idea that they would actually go with a story without following it to the National Guard archive or to the Pentagon and verifying its actual authenticity is just mind-blowing. But it's not surprising, I guess, given Rather's terrible record. I mean, don't forget that he was practically saluting Bush on David Letterman famously after 9/11. He said, he's my commander-in-chief. All he has to do is tell me where to line up, and I'll do it. And even on the Abu Ghraib scandal, which they did break, I mean, we have to give CBS credit for putting it on the air, they called General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, once they had the pictures and the evidence, confronted him with it, and he said, well, give me a couple of weeks. Please don't do the story. And they sat on it for two weeks, and then later said, well, we went with the story because it was going to break on the Internet, not because it was the right thing to do. So now you have a case of sort of crazy overcompensation, but incredible incompetence by CBS. I don't want to sound like an old geezer. I mean, I'm 48 years old, but I talk to journalism classes. I talk to a lot of young people going to journalism, and I sort of say flippantly, we don't have any reporters anymore. People don't know how to do journalism anymore. And I guess I wasn't exaggerated. Here you got a 72-year-old guy with some experience. He doesn't know what he's doing. It's just unbelievable.
Let's also remember that the same producer who did this story on Bush's National Guard record and got the documents is the one who got the photos in the Abu Ghraib case.
She did get the photos.
Yes, same
producer. Yeah, well, you know, I'll give her credit for that, but I'm just saying that CBS doesn't have a great record. Rather, doesn't have a great record on doing thorough and accurate journalism, as Rather piously said last night. I mean, they've specialized in not asking the tough questions, and this was gratuitous, too. What did we need this for? The record is clear that Bush was given preferential treatment. Just getting into the Guard was a clear case of getting preferential treatment.
Rick
MacArthur.
Dropping
out for a year and so on. Well, what purpose did this serve?
I've been listening to Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity as we were driving into Colorado Springs last night, listening to Hannity's radio show. And it's been amazing to listen to them talk about here getting these documents, not investigating, going with what they believed, which proved that they were partisan. It's interesting to look at that and compare it to what all the media, not just Fox, did in the lead up to the invasion. The kind of scrutiny they said that Dan Rather should use. Can you look at that model, what it would have meant in the lead up to the invasion, what the corporate media should have done?
Well, I mean, Rather also, remember, got the highest rating from Brent Bozell's right-wing media watchdog group. I forget which one it's called, what the name of it is, for his coverage of the Iraq War, of the invasion. In other words, CBS and Dan Rather were the most super patriotic, pro-war or sympathetic to the war network among all the networks. They got a higher grade even than Fox. So when you talk about the corporate media, you have to understand that you're talking about the kept media, and the kept media follows the wishes, follows the tendencies, follows the interests of power. And in this case, power in the form of the Bush administration wanted the war. They wanted to go into Iraq. and Rather and company went along for the ride and distinguished themselves in the eyes of the right wingers. I hope that that people point out Dan Rather's high grade from Brent Bozell when Hannity and company starts talking about the liberal media again, saying, "Oh, look at the liberal media trying to get Bush." It's preposterous. Rather was in the bag during the invasion.
What about all the media? What about all the media applying this same level of scrutiny to the issues of weapons of mass destruction?
Oh, well,
If we'd had
the kind of energy that that Rather, it's incompetent, but it does show some initiative and energy that he showed in this investigation. In theory, there would have been no war. The New York Times, as I've said 100 times, distinguished itself in its production of fraudulent information, which was all served to them by the White House, supporting the thesis that Saddam was on the verge of getting an atomic bomb. It was all false. There was plenty of evidence to the contrary. But the New York Times and the Washington Post just went out of their way to promote the fraudulent premise of the war, and so did most of the rest of the media. There are a couple of distinguished exceptions, the Knight Ridder Washington Bureau, sorry to promote myself, me, and anybody who put Scott Ritter on TV or radio. But beyond that, there wasn't any real scrutiny. On the contrary, there was promotion of the advancing of the administration lies about WMD. Which remember, it's not about weapons of mass destruction back when it counts. It's about an atomic bomb threat. That's what they were promoting, which was the most preposterous of all the premises put forth.
Well, Rick MacArthur, I want to thank you very much for being with us, publisher of Harper's Magazine, and Jim Hoare, author of, among other books, Bush's Brain. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at a radio station that has reversed the trend of media consolidation. It's right here in the Boulder, Denver area, KGNU. Stay with us.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Ha ha.
Mike and Maria.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bullshit.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado, where commercial AM radio station KGME has been bought by the independent Boulder-based radio station KGNU. It is a rare success story of an independent media outlet reclaiming the airwaves from corporate control. Clear Channel Communications, the media giant that owns more than 1,200 radio stations across the country and organized pro-war rallies ahead of the invasion of Iraq, owns 8 stations here in Denver. Religious broadcasters own 10. Denver had no independent community-powered station. The deal was finalized just days ahead of the Republican National Convention. That allowed KGNU to begin broadcasting to the 2 million people of Metro Denver on August 29th, the day that marked the largest political march at a U.S. political convention in U.S. history. Right now, we're going to talk about the significance of this expansion of community radio with three people. On the telephone, we're joined by Bob McChesney. Bob McChesney has written many books on media consolidation, among them Rich Media, Poor Democracy, professor at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. We're also joined in the studio here in Denver by Marty Derlin, who's the station manager at KGNU and chair of the Pacific Board, as well as Chris Abrams, who is the Denver campaign coordinator for KGNU and the former senior producer at Democracy Now! We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Let us begin with Professor McChesney. Can you put this expansion of KGNU, of community radio, in the context of the largest media consolidation in U.S. history that's going on right now?
Development. My congratulations to KGNU and to the people of Denver. But I think the real question here is, how come this is so late? How come this is so rare? How come we're celebrating something like this that should be taking place all the time? And the reason is that we've let these huge companies get for free all these monopoly licenses to airwaves. And then if we want to get one of them back, we have to pay a lot of money to get them, which prices out community groups. And I think that that's the original crime here we should never forget as we celebrate getting one station out of 11,000 on a commercial system.
So do you think this will start a trend?
Well, if there's a lot of money, it might start a trend. And commercial radio is so bad, some of these stations might not have any listeners left, so the prices might begin to come down. But I think the real action here we need to do is political change to blast open these airways so there's more room for nonprofit, non-commercial, and community broadcasters. Because if we're reduced basically to trying to buy stations from what Clear Channel, from the crumbs they can't make money from, even their crumbs cost a lot of money. It's going to be very difficult. There will be some instances where it will work, but I think we're dreaming if we think it's going to change the system substantially.
Chris Abrams, how did this happen?
Well, it was really the corporate media's failure which created the demand in Denver for KGNU, the increased demand. You've just dissected that failure on Democracy Now! And even today on a national level, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN and so on. But this was replicated on a local level all over the country. The papers in Denver, for example, the Denver Post, after Secretary of State General Colin Powell gave that very crucial speech to the UN Security Council ahead of the invasion of Iraq, the war was in the balance. Tens of thousands of lives were in the balance, and the Denver Post said that that speech was enough to dispel any lingering doubt about the threat. They said that that speech provided not just one smoking gun, but many of them. And of course, now none of his claims have been substantiated. The Rocky Mountain News, owned by the same company that owns the Denver Post, after that crucial protest on February 15th, the largest protest in U.S. history, where over 10 million people took to the streets around the globe, the Rocky Mountain News editors wrote that the protesters are unwittingly helping to keep Iraq's arms dump secret and Baghdad's torture chambers in business. It's really important not to forget the role that the local media played as well in bringing this country to war. And people in Denver stood up and said no. They realized they weren't getting the full story, and they demanded an alternative.
So, Marty Derlin, how did you respond to the demand from Denver?
Well, we ended up with an $80,000 surplus the year the war started. And we looked at that and said, what should we do with this? How can we use this as leverage in a way? So we decided to sort of seize the moment. We felt a responsibility to the First Amendment, really, all the rights of the First Amendment, and a feeling that we really needed to enhance freedom of expression, both in music and in news, just unavailable except on the left end of the dial where non-commercial community radio stations are. We talked about it within our community. Could we do this? Should we do this? We realized we couldn't do it alone, so we contracted with Public Radio Capital, a group that had helped larger public radio stations do this kind of thing, to purchase frequencies in the commercial band. So we worked with them. We found Chris available to help us. That was certainly crucial in making this happen. We needed a focused point person. It helped to that Chris had the background both in alternative media and in organizing. None of us had background in raising huge amounts of money from major donors, so we brought in Kim Klein, who's really San Francisco-based guru of fundraising for progressive causes. She came in and taught us how to do it. And from February to August, we raised more than $1.2 million.
Chris, you were the point person, as Marty Derlin says. How did you raise this $1.2 million?
Well, the training session with Kim was crucial. The most important lesson I learned from her is that donors appreciate the opportunity to give to revolutionary, effective campaigns like this. And that really played itself out. It was a huge lesson, and it is a revolutionary campaign. I remember so clearly working with you at Democracy Now! During the Pacifica struggle and thinking, this is an amazing amount of organizing going on to save this network. After we win that struggle, how can we turn that in a positive direction, not just to defend the few channels of expression we have, but to start taking back other mediums for expression, other channels? And donors saw that this is not just playing defense, but playing offense, finally creating an independent media outlet that will be around for years to come. And then the election played a role as well. People realized the corporate media wasn't giving a full range of opinion, a full debate. People all over the political spectrum expressed the need for a real in-depth public debate in this democracy. Supporters of Howard Dean realized the corporate media skewered him. Supporters of Kucinich realized that this country will never elect a dissident candidate until we have a strong independent media. And when you give to political campaigns, we realize that that money, most of it goes to the corporate media in the form of airtime for political ads, and then it disappears. And so here was a chance to create an independent media outlet that would provide an in-depth debate and be around for years to come. And so the largest donation we've received so far was $250,000. Couple wishing to remain anonymous, longtime supporters of KGNU. $40,000 we received from an outraged Bush voter who couldn't believe what he was doing. Another woman who wishes to remain anonymous gave $50,000. She'd never heard of Democracy Now! Or independent community radio before, but was so convinced by how strategically this money was going to be used that this is the most important thing she could give to in this year. So that's what we told people, and it really worked. People want an alternative, and they're willing to put their money to that alternative.
So, Marty Derlin, where do you go from here? As we flew into Denver yesterday and came into Denver Airport, it was quite something to be able to turn to, what was it, 1390 AM, and to hear KGNU all the way in Boulder.
Yeah, it's very exciting for all of us. We have to let people know it's there. That's the first thing, and that's a grassroots effort for us. Word of mouth, listservs, just trying to get the word out. We've had an outreach coordinator working with us, Vaishali Mishra, in the Denver area, talking to nonprofit groups and activists. So that's a big part of it. We want to become a real community resource for the diverse communities of Denver. And that involves a discussion within KGNU about community. What does it mean? What is a community? We'll be working off the fund of trust and history of working together that we have for 25 years at KGNU. We know that conflict will inevitably arise in an open-door media organization. We've learned how to deal with it. We hope we can carry that forward into this new chapter for KGNU. And, of course, the issue of how our programming may change as our community expands And we still have a lot of money to raise.
Well, what about that, Chris Abrams?
Well, the purchase price for the AM station was $4.1 million, and we've raised just over $1.2 million so far. So we've got at least another $3 million to raise just for the signal. We're not talking about increased staff or new news and public affairs programming from Denver. And if it takes us the 3 years that we have allocated to raise that money, that's going to be an additional $400,000 in interest. So there's a lot left to do. We're still looking for that $1 million angel investor. We're launching a 1390 squared campaign in honor of the new signal. So if 1,390 people become founding members of KGNU Denver by giving $1,390, that's nearly $2 million. That's the power of relatively small donations, and people can make those donations over time. And it also goes to the broader question of where does the independent media movement go from here? You know, what do we do with this knowledge? We know the corporate media is failing us. We know that they served as a megaphone for power. We know that they played a role in bringing this country to war. We know that they keep the two-party system in place. So when you hear this, when you know that, what do you do? Do you maintain what you're doing, or do you try to expand? Do you try to reach new people? Arundhati Roy, the Booker Prize-winning author of The God of Small Things and now a leader of the anti-war movement and the global justice movement, said simply, we must make the corporate media irrelevant. And that's what this campaign is about. It's about strengthening independent community radio station, one community radio station, KGNU in Boulder, strengthening the programming, but also reaching 2 million more people. And this needs to happen all over the country. That's what this campaign is about.
Hmm. Tonight, we're going to Olby in Denver for part of a Pacifica series of town halls. Chris, maybe you could talk about that. We're going to be broadcasting this also on parts of it, on Democracy Now, what it means to have a media that provides a forum for debate.
We're starting off with a debate on gay marriage. We have an attorney from Equal Rights Colorado and a spokesperson from the Family Research Council. Should be a very interesting debate. And then we're broadening it into a panel discussion on how and whether politicians play on fear and prejudice in winning votes. And the idea behind this is not just to create a 2-hour broadcast, but to show people what community radio is. I mean, Denver has not had the opportunity to have these in-depth discussions on local and national issues. And so this is going to be a window into what that is. And it's the event is tonight at 7 o'clock at the Central Presbyterian Church, 1660 Sherman Street. You can call 303-449-4885 for tickets. And if you want more information on this campaign, you can call that number or go to our website, kgnu.org, or email me at kris@kgnu.org.
Well, I want to thank you both very much. Also, Bob McChesney, do you see this as a viable option for other community media? You're chair of the Pacifica board, which is more than Pacifica's more than the five stations. It's about the community media movement in this country, Marty.
Well, I hope so. I hope there are less expensive ways to reclaim the media. Bob McChesney talked about the corporate media taking over the dial in the left end where non-commercial stations are mandated to be. There are many religious broadcasters who have gobbled up that spectrum as well. So I think we need to be alert, I think, for any opportunity to get any frequency. And I also want to say that the low power movement is a big step in the right direction, reclaiming pieces of our broadcasting spectrum.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Chris Abrams and Marty Derlin. And I also want to thank you, Chris, for all your incredible work at Democracy Now! Over the more than 2.5 years that you were there. Your dedication, your intelligence, your sensitivity, your organizing abilities, and getting us through some of the darkest days as we hunkered down in that firehouse in those first days, and also making that transition from radio to radio and television, and now reaching close to 300 stations around the country. You really were seminal in making that happen, and thank you. And thank you for doing it here as well. That does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Quddus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan as we broadcast here at Rocky Mountain PBS. Our website is democracynow.org, and we'll have all the links to the discussions we had today. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. Thanks for joining us.